What rights do the Syrian refugees have? Who has to respect those rights? Who decides if someone is a refugee? What even is a refugee? Can U.S. governors prevent them from entering their states? Find out answer to these questions on this episode of The End of the Law. Hello and welcome to The End of the Law, the show that looks at what happens when the extremes of humanity meet the fringes of the law. Every other week, we'll dive into some current event and see whether the law can handle modern messes. I'm Grant Shubin, and I guide this tour through confusion. Today's episode is about the Syrian refugee crisis, about how refugees are processed, what laws apply to them, and what their status is once they've legally entered the United States. Before that, though, let's get into some questions that one or two of you thoughtful listeners had about the last show, which covered NSA spying programs. As a recap, you might remember that the NSA had two domestic spying programs, both of which were probably legal. The first gathered bulk cell phone metadata from all American cell phone calls, and that program was legal because it did not collect things in which we have a reasonable expectation of privacy, and it just took the metadata. The second program took information which we do have a reasonable expectation of privacy, but was also legal because of a somewhat unofficial national security exception to the warrant requirement. About these programs, Kate from San Francisco asked if the NSA was intentionally infringing our liberties in taking this information. The short answer is no. In fact, because of the current contours of the law, the NSA was not illegally infringing on anything. Now, I tried to make the point that the current contours of the law might not match up with what we want, but that doesn't mean the NSA was intentionally taking any liberties away. The second question came from Bill here in Brooklyn, and he asked about the secret court overseeing the programs, which was a good catch because I actually only mentioned it in passing. Basically, that court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, is the body that the NSA or the FBI have to go to get permission to look at certain emails or access specific cell phone metadata from the bulk collections. I called that court secret because it deliberates in secret, its decisions are secret, and it's overseen by a similar court that deliberates in secret and has secret decisions. That being said, the court's existence and which judges are on it, that's all public information. President Obama has declassified some of the court's decisions, which is how I knew that they upheld the gathering of American emails as legal because of a national security exception. All right, enough of that, though. Let's dig into today's show, the Syrian refugee crisis. I was actually a bit reluctant to choose refugees as a show topic because you can't really turn on the news from anyone without hearing something about it. The media is a bit saturated with it. But I went ahead anyway because a lot of the coverage, a lot of the discussion surrounding the Syrian refugee crisis leaves a bunch of blanks on areas that seem to me to be pretty important. With that in mind, I'm going to talk about three things. I'm going to talk about the legal basis of becoming a refugee, how the U.S. deals with bringing refugees in, and are the things that governors and presidential candidates are saying that they would do if the refugees come in, are they legal? In other words, this one's going to be kind of a doozy. And it's a little bit awkward because the legal basis of refugees is a question of international law, while the question of how the U.S. is dealing with it is a question of domestic law. But it wouldn't really make sense to talk about refugees in the U.S. if you didn't know how a refugee was defined internationally. But I tried to structure the show in a way that makes sense, so I guess we'll just see. So first, we're going to talk about international refugee law, who it protects, what it does, and then we're going to talk about the process by which the U.S. resettles refugees inside our borders, and then we're going to talk about whether the governors can keep Syrians out of their states. But first, let's set the stage a little bit. Syria's been in a bitter, bitter civil war since 2011. Starting with government crackdowns on peaceful protests during the Arab Spring, the conflict has evolved into a horror show of human rights abuses, violations of the laws of war, and utter breakdown of public services, and a widespread economic collapse. The conflict has highlighted the social, political, sectarian tensions within Syria and destroyed homes, infrastructure, and not to mention entire cities. And, of course, it's led to the creation of the world's newest psychopathic boys club, ISIS, or ISIL, or Daesh, or whatever you want to call them. Most importantly for the show, however, it's created the humanitarian crisis. In the 4 years since the beginning of the war, half of the Syrian population has been killed, displaced, or has fled, something like 11 million people in total. Of that, about 4 million are refugees in neighboring states or been resettled elsewhere. And you've probably heard a lot about these refugees. They've done just about everything they can to flee the horrors of their home, and they've risked death in any number of ways to get somewhere more stable to live. They've overwhelmed neighboring countries, they've clawed European borders, They've provided cover for terrorists, and just about the only place they've been welcome is in stump speeches of political candidates trying to keep them out. But there's more to this crisis than finds its way into the papers or onto your least favorite friend's most favorite Facebook status. There's a whole slew of international and domestic laws that should be forming the conversation we're having about these people, and it all starts with the Refugee Convention. More accurately, it's the convention relating to the status of refugees created in 1951, and that's the foundation of international refugee law. Actually, really what we use now is the additional protocol to the convention, because the convention originally only covered people fleeing Europe as a result of World War I following before 1951, but we still refer to the convention as the basis of international refugee law. And in the interest of making an academic point here, the convention only applies to countries that have ratified it. 148 countries in total have ratified either the convention or the additional protocol. Two hugely important countries in the Syria situation that have not ratified it are Jordan and Lebanon, each hosting a massive number of Syrian refugees, something in the millions. But the laws of the conventions might apply to Jordan and Lebanon if they take on what's called customary international law status. It's actually generally what international law is made up of, treaties like the convention and custom. For something to be a customary international law, countries must follow a general practice by a sense of legal obligation. What is considered general practice is not settled, but 148 countries out of somewhere around 190 is right around that threshold. And even if all the individual rules in the convention aren't considered customary law, many of them are. This is all to say that I'm going to refer to the rules in the convention as if they apply to all countries, and that's likely true with some exceptions here and there. Anyway, the convention defines refugees and sets the minimum standards for treatment of refugees, meaning that countries, if they want, can provide more protections for refugees, but not less. And lots of countries have chosen to do exactly that, either in their own domestic laws or in regional treaties with countries nearby. Well, you might ask, what is a refugee? A refugee is a person who is outside his or her home country, who is unable or unwilling to return home due to a well-founded fear of persecution based on his or her race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership to a particular social group. To state that again to make sure it seeps in, a refugee is a person who is outside his or her home country, who is unable or unwilling to return due to a well-founded fear of persecution based on his or her race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership to a particular social group. For purposes of the Syrian refugee crisis, what this means is that a refugee is a person who has either fled or is not in Syria and can't go back because if she does, she'll be persecuted by ISIS or the Assad regime or the opposition for her race, religion, or political opinion, or for belonging to a particular social group. So based on this definition, who cannot be a refugee? Well, people who have not crossed international borders, by definition, cannot be a refugee because they're not outside their home country. So people fleeing conflicts in Burma or in the Philippines or fighting in Nigeria or the Congo but staying inside their country aren't refugees. They're what's called internally displaced persons or IDPs, something you might have heard before. Also, people who do not fear persecution in their home state are not eligible for refugee status. And I'm specifically thinking here of the terrorists who took part in the Paris attacks and apparently got there by posing as a refugee in Greece. Clearly, that guy was treated as a refugee, but likely was not one. He obviously did not fear persecution by ISIS. He was part of ISIS. The convention also specifically excludes some people from being considered refugees. Namely, and this one dates back to World War II, people who are already receiving assistance from some UN organ can't be refugees. And more important for our purposes, people who are seriously considered to have committed crimes against peace or war crimes or crimes against humanity or other serious crimes. So even if a member of ISIS did flee Syria or northern Iraq fearing persecution, he wouldn't necessarily be a refugee if he took part in any of the, at this point, ubiquitous crimes of ISIS like torture or slavery or rape or whatever else. So that's what a refugee is, but what does being a refugee mean? What rights do you have if you're a refugee? Well, for one, you get permanent residence in the host country. More importantly, though, and one of the most basic principles of refugee law, you're guaranteed non-refoulement. That is, you're protected from being sent back to the place where you would be threatened. This right is universally acknowledged and spans tons of other legal regimes like the Convention Against Torture, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights. And however universal, there are two important restrictions to the principle of non-refoulement. Refugees cannot claim this protection if there are reasonable grounds to think that they are a threat to the national security of the host nation, or where they have been convicted of a serious crime and pose a danger to the host nation. Under the convention, refugees are also entitled to a bunch of other rights to varying degrees. These include the right to liberty and security in the person, the right to family life, a right to education, a right to be provided social security, access to justice, access to the courts, freedom of religion, a right to housing, a right to engage in employment, and a bunch of other things that make life in a place normal. Okay, so that's who a refugee is and what a refugee has, but who decides if a person is a refugee? Or more accurately, who decides who is granted asylum? And that's kind of an important distinction that I'm not sure gets very clearly drawn in the media coverage. Asylum is kind of like a travel visa. It means that you can permanently reside in the host state. Before people are formally determined to be refugees, they're asylum seekers. Once they're determined to be refugees, they're granted asylum. That process, formally named Refugee Status Determination Process, is left to individual countries or the host countries, and therefore it's highly individualized based on each country's system. Typically, refugee status determinations are conducted by an official of some special government department or agency, and in most cases, these people are experts in refugee laws. They interview the asylum seeker to evaluate whether he or she is credible, is entitled to being awarded refugee status. It's up to the asylum seeker to prove that he or she is a refugee. That person can usually present as much evidence as possible to show that they can't go back to their country for fear of persecution for, say, their religion. Somewhat importantly, the convention states that asylum seekers' illegal entrance into the host country, that is, without a visa or a passport, is not allowed to be used against them. Put another way, illegal or undocumented entry into a country doesn't matter when determining if a person is a refugee. If the official finds that the asylum seeker has a well-founded fear of persecution based on one of the five grounds, she determines the applicant a refugee and grants them asylum. If not, applicants can appeal or try for some other form of more limited protection. I should mention that in whatever country an asylum seeker begins this process is where they're going to end up if they're determined to be a refugee. This is part of the complication in Europe with people trying to get into Germany through land borders in countries like Hungary. So that's a very generic rundown of the process of becoming a refugee, but some countries don't have these processes, especially if they're not parties of the Refugee Convention, countries like Jordan and Lebanon. In these countries, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, or UNHCR, carries out the status determinations. UNHCR's processes are similar to those of individual countries in that asylum seekers must register at a UNHCR local office. They have a right to an in-person interview. They're allowed legal representation. They can bring witnesses. They're entitled to explanations if they're denied. And if they're granted refugee status, they get a UNHCR refugee certificate guaranteeing them certain things like protection from non-refoulement. UNHCR usually determines refugees on an individual basis, but it can declare whole groups refugees if there's a large group of individuals who need protection urgently. What's crazy is, as far as I can tell, and this comes from UNHCR's website a couple of days ago, they're still doing individual status determinations for Syrian refugees, some 4 million people to date. UNHCR also has one other very important role in all this. It helps resettle refugees to third countries where it's not possible for them to repatriate, or when they can't be accommodated or in whatever country they've fled to. This is largely what's happening to the Syrian refugees in Turkey and Jordan and Iraq and Lebanon and North Africa. These places can't accommodate all 4 million refugees flooding across their borders, so they're setting up what's called, quote, temporary protection to get the asylum seekers processed and then resettled either in their country or in third countries like in the EU or the US, which brings us to the next topic, the US Refugee Admissions Program. The U.S. Refugee Admissions Program is how people who have already been determined to be refugees get permanently resettled in the U.S. The process is ridiculously long, potentially taking up to 7 years, and it's next-level comprehensive. Also, and this shouldn't be ignored, the program is very necessary. The countries bearing the brunt of this crisis are struggling to provide even the most basic services for the refugees. So the first thing to note about the U.S. admission program is that refugees can't just willy-nilly get into the program. They have to be referred to it by UNHCR. In making these referrals, UNHCR selects the most vulnerable refugees who do not pose a threat to the resettlement country. To make sure they do a good job, they have to follow a global set of criteria and look for particular types of people, people like women at risk or survivors of torture or children. To find the most vulnerable refugees, UNHCR has an entirely different process than the one we just talked about. This one, the one to vet established refugees for resettlement, collects identity documents, it records biodata information, it takes iris scans, and conducts interviews to make sure the refugee in question really needs resettlement. And these interviews can take hours, and they're scrutinized for inconsistencies. the questions are very specific and might ask things like, tell me what happened from the time the conflict began to when you left your home. When did you actually leave Syria? How did you leave Syria? What transport did you use? Were you ever involved in any violence in any way? Have you ever had communication with anyone who has used violence in any way, even if it's defensive? What's your mother's name? What's your father's name? And so on. And each of these questions lead to their own branchings of new and follow-up questions. After this first interview with UNHCR, a caseworker determines if there are any credibility concerns, and if not, passes the case to a higher-level expert for review of each detail. If a problem arises, people can be re-interviewed or the cases can be dropped altogether. If UNHCR finds that the refugee is no threat and fit for settlement, they send the entire case to one of any number of governments, the United States included. Cases referred to the U.S. go to one of 9 resettlement support centers around the globe and that are monitored by the State Department. These offices collect identity documents and re-interview the refugees being considered. During this process, quote, biographic security checks begin, and they're carried out by the National Counterterrorism Center, the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, and the State Department. And in the case of Syrian refugees, this information goes under, quote, enhanced review, though I wasn't able to figure out what that was. In a third interview, U.S. immigration officers examine the refugee's case and make a final decision about resettlement, decisions which are themselves reviewed by multiple levels within the Department of Homeland Security. Finally, fingerprints are collected and screened against federal security databases, and if there are any red flags, the case is delayed or denied. And in fact, in any of these cases, the case can be outright denied at any point in the process. When all is said and done, by the time a refugee resettles in the United States, she's undergone at least 5 interviews and has had every detail of her biographic data evaluated several times by security-related government agencies. So that's it. And one obvious question that arises from this is, should we be as scared of resettling Syrian refugees as governors and presidential candidates would have us be? For my money, the answer to that question is obvious, but the more menacing than using refugee resettlement as a political tool is the ways in which that tool is being used. In a case that wasn't obvious, I'm talking specifically here about the 31 governors that have said they will not let Syrian refugees into their states. Setting aside whether or not that makes sense given the robustness of the resettlement program, is it even legal? Well, funny you should ask, because that's what we're going to get into next. Turning now to what happens to refugees once they've entered the U.S., let's be really clear about what the controversy is. Typically, for the last 4 years or so, the U.S. has had a refugee resettlement cap of about 75,000, meaning that no more refugees than that could resettle in the States in a given year. A few weeks ago, and I think it was right before the Paris attacks, President Obama said that he was increasing that number to 85,000 for 2016, with the extra 10,000 being Syrian refugees. This move has been criticized as a national security threat, particularly after the Paris attacks, and has prompted some, well, creative critiques from Republican presidential candidates. It's also led to 31 governors to declare that they're not going to let Syrian refugees into their states. And to Obama's credit, even after the attacks in Paris, he's standing firm on his plan of bringing an additional 10,000 Syrian refugees into the United States. So there it is. That's the grudge match. Obama saying he's going to resettle 10,000 Syrian refugees in the country in 2016, and 31 governors saying they're not going to let the refugees in. So who has the law on their side? Who's going to win, Obama or the governors? To keep it simple, it's Obama. The law is on Obama's side. The long and more technical answer is ultimately rooted in various provisions of the Constitution, including the Supremacy Clause, the Immigration and Naturalization Clause, Equal Protection and Substantive Due Process, as well as at least one federal law. The Supremacy Clause states that federal law is the, quote, the supreme law of the land, which basically just means that when it comes up against state law or an act of a state official, federal law wins. State law is what lawyers called, quote, preempted in that case. In the case of the Syrian refugees, there are a couple of federal laws that preempt the governor's claims that they won't let refugees into their states. Firstly, the Constitution's Immigration and Naturalization Clause, which is actually pretty simple, states that the federal government controls immigration, meaning that states have no say in who comes in or out of the United States. Also somewhat at play here are the president's powers to control foreign policy and relations with other states. But easily the most on-point federal law here is the Refugee Act of 1980. That act declared it the historical policy of the United States to respond to urgent needs of refugees and gave the president broad discretion to handle, quote, unforeseen emergency refugee situations with grave humanitarian concerns, much like the Syrian refugee crisis. In a sentence, the Supremacy Clause in the Refugee Act make it quite clear that whether or not Syrian refugees are resettled in the United States is wholly the realm of the federal government, and state action on the issue is trumped or preempted by whatever the federal government chooses to do. In other words, governors' claims to keep Syrian refugees out of their states would not be legal. Well, you might be thinking, wait a minute, Grant, what if the refugees go to a state like California where the governor is welcoming them and then they're just kept out of states like Arizona? In other words, can governors keep refugees out of their states once they're already here and settled, resettled in other states? Or what about if states just withhold government money from these refugees, disincentivizing them from wanting to be in their state? Well, no, states probably can't do these things either because of the Equal Protection and Due Process clauses in the 14th Amendment. As for equal protection, all the Constitution says is that no state shall deny any person equal protection of the laws. Basically, it just means that states can't overly or wrongfully discriminate against people. Laws and state action must more or less be equal in their application. However, this is a lot harder than it actually sounds. All laws, in their own way, discriminate against somebody. Background checks on gun purchasing discriminate against people who want to buy guns. Laws saying that marriage is between one man and one woman discriminate against gay and lesbian couples. And laws or government actions denying Syrian refugees into states while letting others in would discriminate, well, against Syrian refugees. And to be really very general about an absolutely massive area of constitutional law here, depending on the classification of person being discriminated against, different tests apply as to whether a particular law violates the Equal Protection Clause. For resident aliens and people like refugees, the test applied is the most stringent one, the one that's referred to as, quote, strict in name but fatal in practice, as in there's no way anything ever passes it. Governors keeping refugees out of their states and not providing for them is probably included in this. I think only one case has ever been upheld under strict scrutiny. The same strict scrutiny test applies to resident aliens as a matter of due process, which protects people against deprivation of life, liberty, and property without due process of law. Typically, due process relates to just that, processes, meaning that the government can't take your property without going through certain processes to make sure it's legal. They can't put you in prison or put you to death without going through certain processes, namely trials and sentencing and appeals and such. But there's also substantive due process, where we get a bunch of other various rights, things like the right to marry, the right to obtain abortion, and in this case, the right to travel around the states freely. For the most part, the Supreme Court has held denying benefits to new residents to a state fails the strict scrutiny test. Ultimately, people have a due process right to travel around the United States freely. Okay, so I'm afraid that this has gotten a bit too technical, but the major take-homes are that, one, the Supremacy Clause means that the president's resettling of refugees in U.S. trumps anything governors might do to prevent Syrians from resettling in their states. And two, anything else governors might do would likely violate the Equal Protection and Due Process Clauses of the 14th Amendment. All right. Holy moly, that's a lot. And hopefully it's not too overwhelming. We covered three really broad things. First, we covered what is a refugee, what rights do refugees have, how do you become a refugee. Secondly, we talked about the rigorous process refugees have to go through to be resettled in the U.S. And third, we talked about how governors trying to keep refugees out of their states in the face of Obama's policy to accept 10,000 Syrian refugees next year would likely violate the Supremacy Clause, the federal government's control over immigration, the Refugee Act, as well as the Equal Protection and Due Process Clauses. But more broadly, what does it mean if we don't let Syrian refugees settle in the U.S.? What does it say about us and our respect for the rule of law? The Syrian war has wholesale eroded into madness in part because of an abandonment of the law. Wars and armed conflicts and even civil wars have laws and norms and customs that each side is supposed to follow. These laws are as old as war itself and are typically highly respected, but in Syria they've been largely cast aside. Whether it's President Assad's use of chemical weapons against the armed opposition, blanket barrel bombs destroying entire cities, the intentional targeting of civilians or homes or hospitals, and the recruitment and use of children in the conflict, and of course ISIS's mass killings and mass rapes and slavery and persecution, you name it, the laws of armed conflict and human rights laws have been absolutely ignored in Syria. And this is what Syrian refugees are fleeing, a lawless and hellish chaos where even finding the most basic needs is impossible. We shouldn't meet the challenge of this situation by ourselves flouting the laws that govern us and our role in this conflict. If we did, for one, we're abandoning a bunch of people who need us, but also we're abandoning a legal structure we've put in place after years of learning and relearning how to be better at this whole being on Earth with other people thing. And this really isn't new thinking, but mass migrations of people might become the new norm. Think about when sea level rises, the 2 or 4 or 15 or 20 feet scientists have estimated it will in the next 50 years. Even if the lowest numbers prove to be true, we're talking about an absolutely titanic movement of people from their homes. What happens when whole towns or cities or states or regions return to the water? How are we going to deal with the people who literally lost the land they lived on? Really, all I'm getting at here is that we have to use the law as a guide for lessons learned, and in particular because mass human movement crises are probably going to become a major feature of the future. All this annoying, high-minded self-reflection aside, we should embrace the Syrian refugees as a tactic to defeat ISIS. I don't reckon we're going to defeat them by dropping bombs or even invading and killing every single last one of them. We won't defeat them that way because we're battling an ideology, an idea of an Islamic caliphate that shines in its opposition to the West and our materialism and secularism and corruption and whatever else they say. In no unsure terms, that's exactly what ISIS is trying to do. It's taken territory. They're controlling it. They're offering civil services, healthcare, a justice system, taxation, all the things that make it look a little bit like the haven for Muslims that they've intended all along, except for one key fact. Ordinary Muslims are fleeing ISIS-controlled areas. ISIS literally has propaganda machines to convince people to stay in their territory and not join the infidels. They incentivize people to stay with high pay and giving people property. Still, people are fleeing. And that's a pretty strong indictment of ISIS's goal of developing a functioning state. And it's an even stronger indictment if we, meaning the rest of the world as infidels, provide a stable, welcoming, and egalitarian place to resettle the Muslim people that couldn't and didn't want to live under ISIS until Syria returns into some semblance of order. I have to imagine that this is one of the things ISIS is most truly afraid of, and I doubt I'm alone in thinking that this is part of what motivates them to carry out attacks abroad. If ISIS attacks France or Belgium or the US and it literally freaks us out to the point where we're shutting down our borders, people in ISIS-controlled territory no longer have anywhere to flee and the caliphate can continue to function because it has a population. If we don't shut down our borders and embrace the refugees, ISIS will continue to hemorrhage people and will continue to erode their ideology. In short, let's just all be one big happy family. That's it for today's show. Be sure to listen to our next episode on discrimination against women when dealing with sexual violence in armed conflict. Also, please email me at theendofthelaw.com with any questions or comments or show ideas. I'm Grant Shubin. Be sure to check out Apples and Oranges coming up next. You're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. This is The End of the Law, and this is the end of the show. Thank you for listening.